Greater Boston Today.
Hosted by George Knight.
Public service programming
on Beasley Media Group stations.
Well, it has been a tough couple weeks with a recent mass shooting in Texas, and before that, the attack in Buffalo, New York, which had racist motives behind it. The issue of racism is scary. It's frustrating. It's confusing. And it's an issue that will only get better if people talk about it and better understand the issue and each other. I'm going to try and up that level of understanding today by speaking with Dr. Philippe Copeland. Dr. Copeland is a clinical assistant professor at the Boston University School of Social Work. He is assistant director of narrative for the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research and someone who has worked hard toward the ultimate goal of a world without racism. Dr. Copeland, thank you so much for coming on. I'm very grateful.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Where to begin with this subject? Oh, my goodness. I want to touch on a few different things. And if it's okay, I just want to ask you, starting off, if you could talk a bit about the history of racism in our country. You know, certainly dates back to the beginning of the country and slavery. And also, how did the racism of over 200 years ago look different than racism in 2022?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a very, very good question. It's difficult to summarize, you know, 2+ centuries of history.
Right.
But I think if we go back to the origins of what will become the United States, I think it's important to understand a couple things. One is that those origins are rooted in some very specific forms of systemic violence.
Yep.
One being colonization and genocide of the indigenous population. The other being the enslavement of Africans, and the third being the exploitation of all laborers of all racial categories, so-called free laborers. And that it's important to see that those roots are intertwined. That includes the exploitation of working class, lower class white people as well. And I think that when we understand that, you know, the country that we have become is rooted and systemic acts of violence, of domination, of exploitation, of exclusion, then it's really not surprising that we see things like what happened in Buffalo. However, the other thing that we need to understand is that what has become the United States is also rooted in resistance to the things that I described.
Yeah.
The resistance of the indigenous population to colonization and genocide, the resistance of enslaved Africans to enslavement, the resistance of exploited laborers to their exploitation. And sometimes these groups work together to fight against their shared experience of systemic violence. So we have a heritage of racism, but we also have a heritage of what could be called anti-racism. We have powerful ancestors that we can draw on for inspiration. That includes the white population. Racism is a choice. It is not inherent. Yeah. It is not the only heritage that white Americans have, and it's not the only future that's available to them. And so I think that those are also important things to sort of understand in terms of what makes America what it is both racism and anti-racism.
Dr. Philippe Copeland is with the Boston University School of Social Work. We're talking about racism in America. You started to go down this path, but I wonder if we could go down a little bit further to talk about causes of racism, what factors contribute to someone having a racist mindset. You know, you think of things like ignorance, anger, you know, you touched on that. Mm-hmm. Are there other things in education, perhaps, how that plays into it?
In many ways, the story really begins with what scholars have referred to as racial capitalism. Racial capitalism, the way I think about it, is that it's the use of racism for economic and social gain. Very clear example of this is the enslavement of Africans. That was an economic system. That was an economic system of exploitation, labor exploitation of the most extreme and brutal form that was racialized as a way to justify it, right? To say that we are going to kidnap an entire group of people, millions of them, force them to work under brutal conditions with no compensation, but then say that it's okay to do that because there's something wrong with those people, that those people are not people, and in fact, that they are not worthy of freedom. They are only fit to be enslaved and to be brutalized, right? And so that's an example of the, if you will, the profit motive, the class motive behind this problem. And I think that we need to be really explicit about that, because when we don't, I think we miss the bigger picture, that the motivation for racism is not primarily racist attitudes per se. It's it's a political and economic project that seeks to enrich the few at the expense of the many. Mm. And in that process, right, most people are actually disposable, including a lot of the white population, particularly lower class white people. And this has been true since the colonial era, right? And so I think it's really important to understand it in those terms. I was actually thinking about this morning, and I was thinking about the analogy of a fish in the water, right? Sometimes we think about racism as the fish. There's something wrong with the fish.
Yep.
A different way of thinking about it is that there's something wrong with the conditions under which the fish is living. And that when you live under toxic conditions, you get toxic behavior. Mm. That's what happens to human beings. And this isn't just racism. We see this in many aspects of life. When you subject human beings to toxic conditions, you get toxic behavior, you get toxic attitudes, you get all kinds of inequities, you get violence. And so it really isn't a surprise that we see these kinds of things happening in society, because we all continue to live under these conditions. And so racism is the water, it's not the fish. And if we really want to do something about this problem, we have to do something about the water.
Fix the water, the environment.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. Dr. Philippe Copeland is with Boston University School of Social Work. We're talking about racism. Can we go over different forms of racism, how it rears its head? I mean, there's the obvious blatant racism, mm-hmm. but there are also less obvious forms. Can you talk about the ways that racism can present itself?
Yeah, well, you can think about it as having a variety of different dimensions. A lot of people talk about systemic racism, right? And so this is the way that racism functions in the way that, you know, institutions, organizations, fields, disciplines, schools, etc., their everyday business and the way that they function. Because most of these things were created at a time where the goal was to enrich wealthy whites at the expense of everybody else.
Right.
And so those things are doing what they were designed to do. You know, I say that it's a feature, it's not a malfunction, right? So that's the structural piece. The things that support the structure are things like ideas or ideology. Right. And so one of the things that happens with racism is that you have to try to convince people that racism is rational. Right. That it makes sense to be racist. Right. There are people who call themselves so-called race realists right now that kind of gets into what you wanted to know about replacement theory, who actually try to claim, and they're part of a long tradition of people who have tried to make racism and bigotry sound scientific. They say, well, look, it's just science, right? Some people are inferior and some people are superior, right?
Wow.
We're not being bigots. We're being realistic, you know? There was a time when so-called scientific racism had been sort of discredited, but there's really been a resurgence of it in the past few years. I mean, I can go to conferences, or I guess as a black person, I wouldn't go to these conferences, but a person could go to quote unquote academic intellectual settings and listen to people explain all the reasons that it is a fact that black people are inferior, right? With complete confidence, right? Complete confidence, complete sincerity. I think that some people have pointed out the fact that in the manifesto of the Buffalo massacre terrorist, right, that there was citation of a lot of these ideas, right? This notion that, hey, these are just the facts. These people are not like us, right? And so trying to integrate them, to include them in society, allowing them to have power, allowing them to live next to you, allowing them to marry your daughter, that this is not only irrational, but that it's potentially suicidal, right? That it puts so-called Western civilization at risk, and that these inferior people need to be, at best, controlled and managed, and at worst, they need to go, right? They need to be exterminated, right? So that's that ideological piece, and related to that is a cultural piece. One example of this is that we make sense of the world through stories. And so one of the ways that you spread racist ideas is through storytelling. Very common examples of storytelling that are really powerful, some people call it a master narrative, are racial stereotypes, right? Most of us can recite those stereotypes from memory, even if we don't believe them. because they're so ubiquitous and because most of us have grown up with those stories about those people, right? Those people do this, those people do that, they think this way, they act this way, right? And many of us, you know, we were told these stories by people we love, right? We were told these stories by people we respect. We learned these stories through the culture and the popular culture that we were exposed to, the TV shows that we watched, the children's books that we read, right? Yeah. Again, talking about the water, we've been swimming in that water, right? And so when somebody comes out and they make some sort of a racist claim, you know, many of us have been primed to say, you know, that sounds familiar to me. That makes sense to me. Because this is the story that I've been growing up with. This is what I've been exposed to. And it fits that story. It doesn't contradict that story. So let me just pause there because I said a lot of things. I want to make sure that you didn't have an additional question.
That's exactly what I was hoping for in this.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other aspects to this. There's also a moral dimension. One of the things that I think when you study racism, what you see is that you have to not just make racism sound rational. You have to make it sound ethical, right? So you have to try to convince people that at worst, racism is a kind of necessary evil. Very good example of this is racial profiling, right? You have many people, including very liberal people, who will say, well, look, certain people commit more crime. And so it makes sense that you would profile those people. That's just good sense and it's good safety. And, you know, maybe we don't feel comfortable with it, but that's just what you have to do, right? And so that's a way of trying to make racism sound sort of righteous, right? The other thing that you do is that you dehumanize groups of people, as I said. And so when you turn people into those people, not only is it permissible to treat them differently, but it becomes obligatory. Because these people have to be controlled, they have to be contained, and the people we value, the real people, have to be protected from those people. So really, if you fail to treat those people differently, that's what's wrong. That's what's immoral.
Wow.
We heard similar arguments about the caging of children, taking them from their parents and caging them a couple of years ago under the former regime. And I heard many people defend that with absolutely no sense of doubt that that was necessary, that that was the right thing to do. And that if you didn't treat the families that way, that that was the wrong thing to do. And in fact, that people like me who were trying to say it was wrong, that I was wrong, right? That I was immoral, that I was unethical, that I didn't care about the country or I didn't care about the safety of my neighbors. You see what I'm saying? Really remarkable. But again, it's not surprising because this is part of the way that racism has to work. Right. And then finally, there's the psychological elements that you also asked me about. So you get into things like attitudes. There are people who do research on what they refer to as racial resentment. Right. So the attitude among some whites essentially that racial equality is not really about making the country better. It's about trying to take something from white people as a group. There's internalized racism. There's what's referred to by some as an empathy gap. So difficulty of some people, for example, some white people, to actually empathize with the suffering of people who they see as not part of their group. That's part of the psychology of racism. And so really racism isn't just one thing. Racism is actually a variety of things that when they work together produce particularly really bad outcomes. Like what we saw in Buffalo a couple of weeks ago.
Dr. Philippe Copeland is with Boston University School of Social Work. And I want, you know, you're talking about present day for a lot of that. And so I want to continue with that. If we could talk about where we are in 2022, you know, go back a little bit. I think for many people, it felt like when Barack Obama got elected that maybe, just maybe, we had turned a corner now that a person of color was in the White House. And then after that, it certainly felt like we slid backwards. Now, you know, wondering if you feel that way. And if you do, why that happened? Was, you know, did the racism, was it there all along? It just took a different climate to make it, you know, be okay for people to bring it more to the surface. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. I mean, I think in some ways I had a colleague at that time and she said a very provocative question. She said, well, is the election of Obama the end of racism or the beginning of racism?
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, in very much the tradition of what makes the U.S. the U.S., it was both, right? Our experience of racism has always involved contradiction. And so on the one hand, you had a particular kind of achievement of having a non-white person be elected to the highest office in the land. And on the other hand, you had a pretty significant backlash that came along with that. I would say that the things that we've seen in the last couple of years, and that would include the attack on the Capitol on January 6th,
yep,
are part of really almost like a decade-long backlash that originated with Obama's election and then accelerated during the previous regime of Donald Trump. So that's how I tend to think about it.
Yep.
Yeah, it was both, right? But I think on the whole, and you know, obviously the president Obama wasn't responsible for this. On the whole, I think that his election sent a shockwave through some white Americans who felt that the country as they knew it was coming to an end. Mm. That it was an existential crisis that really required almost a kind of an apocalyptic response, not just in terms of rhetoric, but also in terms of behavior. I think about the massacre at the Charles Street AME church, for example,
yeah,
right? Which in some ways was sort of the beginning of a kind of upsurge of racist terrorism that we've been living with since that time. And again, that Buffalo is just the most recent example of that.
You mentioned earlier about, and this ties in with the Buffalo thing, but about the so-called replacement theory. And I wonder if you could explain a bit further about that.
Yeah, I mean, I touched on it earlier. I mean, I would say, one, that, you know, this the replacement theory is, you know, on the one hand, it you know, it's sort of located in the ideas of particular white supremacists, but it's also a really old idea that's rooted in a way of talking about white experience and really white aggression,
yep,
as self-defense, right? Hmm. One of the most popular justifications for white violence historically has been to claim that white people are just trying to protect themselves, right? That's been going on since at least the colonial era and, you know, really horrific violence against the indigenous population, right? As if the indigenous population was not defending themselves from invasion, right? Complete inversion of reality. If you look at the way that people talked about what was happening at the time and the justifications for the violence against indigenous people, right? So that idea that white people are just trying to make a living, make their way in a hostile world that's full of lawless, lazy, a savage non-white people, and that if and when white people get aggressive, it's just because they're trying to stick up for themselves. It's an old story. And replacement theory is just it's really just a variation on that theme. We hear the same things, right? Those people are going to destroy our civilization, our meaning white civilization, right? They're out to get us. They're coming to get us. And we cannot coexist peacefully with them as equals. That's not possible. And in fact, people, for example, like Jews, let's say, who try to encourage integration and encourage racial equality are actually secretly anti-white, and they're trying to hurt white people. For example, there are people who say that anti-racism is really anti-white, right? That it's a cover for an anti-white agenda. I hear this from many people. Oh. And ironically, you know, I work at a center for anti-racism, right? So,
yeah, right.
But again, it's a variation on that theme, right? White people have to look out for themselves because everybody's out to get them. And to take something from them versus saying that people are trying to live as equals with them.
Dr. Philippe Copeland is with the Boston University School of Social Work. So you know, before I let you go, need to ask the question, you know, where do we go from here? How does a country like the U.S. heal itself when it comes to racism? You know, is it, you know, obviously there's, you know, stuff through government that can be done. But I was thinking before we came on, you know, maybe the power is in the individual. I don't want to get too off track here, but I saw a video on that was on social media about an Uber driver or Lyft driver whose passengers mm-hmm. get in the back. And as soon as they get in, they go, "Oh, you're a white person. Oh, thank goodness." And the guy says, "Get out." says, that's not appropriate. Get out. And I was thinking, you know what? That guy, you know, he didn't make it okay for those people to make those racist remarks. And maybe that's what it's going to take. I don't know. I'm wanting to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, you know, I would say, I like to say that anti-racism is a team sport, but you can learn to be a better team player, yeah. Right? And so I agree that there is work that individuals can do to better prepare themselves to work with others to solve this problem. But that ultimately, I think if we look at where we have made gains historically and also more recently, it's through collective multiracial struggle and solidarity. And some of the change, that personal change that people are looking for, it's not going to happen by reading a book. It's going to happen in the streets. It's going to happen by joining your neighbors right. in a collective effort to make this country a better place to live for all of us. And I believe, and I think that history would support, that that's how things are going to get better, is through that kind of an effort.
I want to give the website for the Center for Anti-Racist Research, because there's a lot of information on there. If you're looking to find out more, you can access them online by going to bu.edu/antiracism-center. bu.edu/antiracism-center. Dr. Philippe Copeland is a clinical assistant professor at Boston University School of Social Work. He is assistant director of narrative for the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. And as we mentioned from the get-go, someone who has worked very hard toward the ultimate goal of a world without racism. I am really grateful for your time. I mean, obviously, it's a complex and ongoing issue, and you know, you helped us understand a bit better, and for that, I'm grateful. Thank you so much, Dr. Copeland.
Thank you for your time, and you know, you take care of yourself. It's kind of rough out there.
Yeah.
And I wish the best to you and yours as well. We're in this together.